You're listening to the Blue Heron podcast series. Blue Heron, directed by Scott Metcalf, is an ensemble of professional singers from Boston that specializes in music from about 1400 to 1600, the golden age of the vocal ensemble. Today's podcast episode takes a look back at Blue Heron's fall 2006 concert called The World of John Dunstable. Massachusetts Institute of Technology's visiting assistant professor Mike Cuthbert was on hand to provide an insightful pre-concert lecture. The music you're hearing in this episode is from the performance that followed the lecture. Let's listen in on Professor Cuthbert and part of his lecture.
This music represents the time of one of the great clashes in music history. A clash of cultures, a clash of ideas, and occasionally a clash of notes. What is this battle? Well, we might call it the musical British invasion, but that term has already been taken. However, there are many similarities between what's happening around the beginning of the 1400s and what happened with the Beatles and these other groups coming over in the 1960s. A group of English musicians and their music left the islands and came to the continent. They brought with them a musical style which was at once new and at the same time compatible with the music that people already knew, so it wasn't totally foreign. They opened the doors for other English musicians to leave the isles and come seek employment in foreign lands. And they also spawned a gaggle of copycats in their new adopted country who wrote music in the English style. Now, of course, there were differences. For one thing, we're not talking about America as the invaded country. We're talking about the continent of Europe, or especially the Low Countries and Italy. For another, this is the music that the instruments were more likely to be sackbuts and shams than guitars and basses. And especially, there's a difference in how the music arrived. Of course, there were no LPs in 1420. We copied the pieces from manuscript to manuscript, placing quill and ink on parchment and paper. Imagine, if you will, it's 1409. You're a singer in the service of an Italian cardinal, and you've been invited to accompany him to a grand conference in Pisa, Italy. Now, why is there a conference? Well, you see, there's a problem with the Pope. Well, not really your Pope. We got two of them. From 1378 to 1417, that's the fundamental problem of the age. How to convince either the French or the Roman Pope, from our standpoint, preferably the French Pope, to sit down and unify Western Christianity. So you and your cardinal go to Pisa to solve this problem. This council at Pisa didn't do much to help Christianity's struggles. What it did do was help music. This was the great networking event of the century, to meet each other and hear each other's music. Now, we know little about what England gained from this exchange, but we know a lot about the admiration the Italians had for English music. The two countries made for a great pair, in part because the Italians did most of the writing down of the music. And from our perspective, that's the important thing, to write it down so we can sing it. So what did the English have that was so good? The English were thought to compose music that was sweeter.
Thank you.
what does it mean to write sweeter music? The common view is that the continental composers, the Italians, the French, they wrote music that used sounds that were entirely consonant, entirely concordant. Or they used sounds that were discordant. As if everything was bitter or saccharine. In contrast, so the stories go, the English used sounds which were neither purely sweet nor completely discordant. We call these sounds imperfect consonances. You can harmonize any melody and get something approximating what Dunstable might have had as a background sound. For instance, here is, God Bless America. Now, you'll rarely hear the sounds so unornamented and stark like this during the concert. But you will hear a progression in time from the earlier pieces which use fewer sounds like this, such as Lionel Power's Gloria early on the program, to his later piece, Ibo Mihi Ad Montem, where these sounds dominate. Now, in addition, we're going to hear a lot of even older music, that is, Gregorian chant. Tonight, it's represented in several ways. First, we're just going to hear it. They're going to sing Gregorian chant as filtered through the English dialect, what we call the Sarum Rite. Next, we'll hear chant being sung at the beginning of some of the mass sections. Something like, Gloria in excelsis Deo. But lastly, and most importantly perhaps, you'll hear the chant, for instance, the Credo near the beginning of the program by Lionel Power has a bottom voice which is a chant, and the chant is called Opem Nobis, and it's sung in honor of St. Thomas Becket, who was murdered in the cathedral. What we do is we take the chant, which goes something like this. And we slow it down. We slow down the chant. And then we sing new music on top of it. Why do we do this? We don't really know. It may be to draw a connection between the meaning of the new texts and the old chant texts. It may be a hidden form of religious devotion on top of a blatant expression of religious devotion. Or it may just be sort of a game that people played to try to see if you could recognize the sound that you were familiar with when it slowed down and disguised. In some pieces, particularly those called isorhythmic motets, the chant will be repeated over and over again, usually each time a little bit faster. So we'll hear this technique in a piece of Dunstable's called Salve Schema Sanctitatis, where the melody, which is dedicated to the Virgin, is going to be heard first excruciatingly slowly. Second, mind-bogglingly slowly, which is a little faster. But then third, you will get to hear it at a mere snail's pace. Now, because these chants are being slowed down, a lot of people believe that you can't really sing these. These are meant for instruments. We should have some instruments playing them. Other people think that with training, you can sing these very long, sustained notes and make them sound beautiful. But the world of 15th century music is not just all slow notes. I don't want to give that impression. It's also a world of intense rhythmic activity. Dunstable's one of the few people about it can truly be said that the only things that are certain are death and taxes. We know when he died, and we know how much and where he paid taxes. And that's all we know for sure about him. We know that from the taxes, he was well paid for his services. And we know he probably wrote a lot of his early music in the teens and 1420s. We believe that he learned a lot from his older colleagues, for instance, Lionel Power, and that he was influential on a younger generation of English composers, including Benningham and Walter Fry. We further know that Dunstable was esteemed among the European composers of his generation, above all others, perhaps save two musicians, Guillaume de Ban, called Banchois, and Guillaume Dufay. We'll hear Banchois's sad song expressing the depth of sorrow, and you'll hear how he chooses to express depth. also hear an isolated Gloria from the great transplant from the north to Italy, Guillaume Dufay. And perhaps hearing the music of a triad of such great composers on today's concert, that might be the event that we call the sweetest concordance. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's program. Blue Heron, directed by Scott Metcalf, is an ensemble of professional singers from Boston that specializes in Renaissance polyphony. For more information about Blue Heron, visit us on the web at www.blueheronchoir.org. The pre-concert lecture was supported by a grant from the Cambridge Society for Early Music. The recording engineer for the pre-concert lecture and concert is Philip Davis from Cape Ann Recording. This podcast is a Tenor Technologies production. For more information about Tenor Technologies, please visit www.tenortech.com.